Hey, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Mel Herbert here for the C3 Project. We're going to talk about syncope, and our own Jess Mason got an interview with a real patient. We're going to present it to you here. And as you're listening to this patient, real history, I want you to ask yourself these questions. Is this patient having a syncopal episode or a seizure episode? Which part of the information that you're hearing is useful and which part is not so useful? Because it's a real patient, there is some sophistication in their answers and there's some misinformation in their answers. And that's all part of being a great clinician, is trying to work out what the heck's going on. Are there high-risk features? Are there low-risk features? Are you going to admit this patient? Are you going to send them home? If you're going to do tests, which test are you going to do? Oh, so many questions. Let's go, Jess.
History.
It's okay with you that I record your voice?
Yes.
Okay. Will you tell me about what happened and what you were feeling tonight?
I was feeling extremely a lot of pain in my chest. It was due to a neighbor causing me stress.
So did that actually make you pass out when you
yes.
felt the pain? Tell me about what happened. What do you remember?
It felt like somebody grabbing my heart and squeezing it, like putting pressure on it where I could not get no air, no function. In other words, I tried catching my breath, but it's like I try to grasp and it wouldn't allow me to get no air. So I did pass out because of that fact.
Did you feel palpitations or racing heart when
yes,
that was going on?
Yes, my heart was beating real fast, constantly. It was just rapid.
Has that ever happened to you before?
It has happened to me one time before, some time ago, a while back. I don't remember when, but yes, it has.
And you actually passed out?
Yes, and I actually passed out on that situation.
All right. And were you feeling any other symptoms? Shortness of breath?
Shortness of breath,
mm-hmm.
Headache, nausea. Pain in the legs, the arms,
mm-hmm.
A lot of headache.
How about sweats? Did you get sweats?
Sweats, yes.
Yeah?
Yes, like okay. A cold fever, like if you would have the flu, yes.
Okay. And do you have any other medical problems?
I have epilepsy.
Mm-hmm.
I had high blood pressure. And I've had a couple of strokes in the past.
When was your last seizure?
Last seizure has been probably about 7.5 years ago to 8 years ago.
What type of seizures do you get?
They're what you call grandma seizures.
Are you on any seizure medicine?
Yes.
What do you take?
Phenobarbital, Tegretol. I was on Dukakis, but they took me off. I was on Tramadol. They took that away. Ibuprofen.
Did anyone see this event today?
My wife and my daughter.
Okay. And did they describe anything for you that may have looked like a seizure?
No, they said it wasn't a seizure. They just said it was just a lapse. It was a pass-out lapse.
Okay. They said it did not look like one of your seizures.
No, because they asked the paramedics. The paramedics asked them.
Mm-hmm.
Policemen asked them. Yeah. So it wasn't,
okay.
No.
Okay.
It wasn't caused that.
And you've been feeling okay lately? No recent illness?
No, not too much. Just, you know, here and there.
Okay.
But it's not nothing that I cannot go see my doctor about.
Stuart, it is that time again. Are you ready for C3?
That is Mizuho Spangler, assistant professor of emergency medicine at the Keck School of Medicine.
Totally.
His name is Stuart Squadron, a.k.a. Captain Cortex, professor of emergency medicine at that same Keck School of Medicine.
We are discussing syncope this month, and man, you know, I have mixed emotions about syncope, because on the one hand, if it's pretty straightforward and benign sounding, it's an easy dispo, but dispo is really the issue here, isn't it?
Well, okay, this is the thing about syncope and what makes it so special, and you can give us the formal definition.
And we could, of course, but we're not going to. As part of our ongoing experiment here, let's ask some of the residents, real residents, from Fresno. And first we're going to talk to Scott Owens. Scott's going to give us a definition. He's an R4. Let's see if he nails it.
What is syncope?
Syncope is a sudden and transient loss of consciousness.
Nailed it.
Basically, you all know that these are patients that look fine.
Yeah.
That's the whole point, is that someone is standing there and saying, and this happened and that happened. And you're like, you look fine.
I want to send you home.
You know, and your vitals are normal.
Yeah.
And so that's what makes it so difficult for us, because we know this is a chief complaint, syncope, where they lost consciousness. And it could be a really serious thing. It could be a cardiac dysrhythmia, but it usually isn't. And they look fine. And so it's all about, you know, I want to send them home. And you are usually right to send these patients home. Most of them do get dispoed home, but there's obviously a lot of stops and checks and balances along the way to make sure that you don't miss one of these bad things. And that's basically what we're going to talk about.
Well, I'm personally really glad we're doing this topic, because honestly, I need a simplified approach. And I think that's what we've done here. So I hope this is useful for many people. Let's quickly talk about the definition. So syncope is defined textbook-wise as a sudden loss of consciousness accompanied by loss in postural tone. So, you know, it's one of the most common presentations in the emergency department. Over three 750,000 people visit the ED in the U.S. for syncope alone, which is why we see this so much every day.
And when you say postural tone,
you pass out. You fall on the ground.
Yeah, that's just a fancy way of saying your body goes limp. And if you happen to be standing, you go to ground. Now, it's interesting because why does this happen? Why does the body do this? Why do we go to ground as a reflex? Well, we do it because when the brain feels that it doesn't have enough blood perfusing it, when we feel that the blood pressure, is just not sufficient to perfuse a brain, the body protects the brain's perfusion by using gravity and by bringing your body to ground so that you can perfuse stuff. It's too hard to pump the blood up to the brain if you've got no blood pressure. Yeah. And so that's really what syncope is that reflex of the body to lose consciousness and go to ground to protect the brain, to turn it down. And it's really neat, actually.
Hello, vagus nerve to the brain. Looks like our human is having a drop in perfusion up to you guys, so we thought we'd better protect him by making him collapse and fall down. Over.
Brain to vagus nerve, that doesn't sound very safe. Over.
It's vagus nerve to the brain. Look, we've been doing this the same way for millions of years. Just shut up and do what we're telling you, okay? Oh, and try to stand next to the porcelain toilet so when he falls down, he'll like crack his head. We really like the sound of that head hitting the porcelain on the way down. Okay, over.
Brain to vagus nerve, this is
Listen,
not...
don't argue with evolution. Do it. Drop him, okay?
Can I mention presyncope then here? Like basically.
Yes, please do. Yeah.
So that's an important distinction, Stu, because presyncope then is that feeling that you're about to go down, but you don't actually, you know, fall down or come down. And so I think that's an important distinction. It's the same type of narrowing in of your vision and lightheadedness that you're feeling right before you were to have a collapse.
That's a really good point. And, you know, I think we were going to talk about this a little later when we talk about the physical exam, but I think a lot of us were taught that in order for you to take it really seriously, that they had a syncope, you know, I've got to see a black eye and a skull fracture, you know, they've got to look like they've did a total face plan and it's got to look horrible in order for you to take it seriously. And okay, it's true. That does definitely tell you, yes, they must have lost consciousness. This must have been real if they've, you know, got bruises all over them. However, like you were saying, just that sensation that you're about to lose consciousness can be every bit as worrisome for a cardiac dysrhythmia.
Yeah.
And so even though, you know, one looks terrible and they've been injured and one doesn't, they both could represent someone who could have a life-threatening event the next time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
May I say it a slightly different way? The differential diagnosis of syncope is quite long and is associated with a number of things that are quite bad, and that's the whole point of this discussion. And the differential diagnosis of presyncope is essentially exactly the same. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Whether you go all the way out, shaboom, or whether you just have that overwhelming sense that you're about to faint, the differential diagnosis, the causes of said complaints are the same.
Differential diagnosis.
So there's many different types of syncope, and we could sit here all day talking about the extensive differential diagnosis. Thankfully, we'll simplify it a little bit, but just remember, the most common type of syncope is vasovagal, and it's very benign, right? More than 58%, Stuart, of syncope is vasovagal. Then the next big category is orthostatic syncope, and that can be from volume loss, like dehydration and diarrhea, or hemorrhage, which we'll get into, or even, you know, syncope can be brought on from multiple things, like emotional reactions and exhaustion and dehydration. So in young, healthy people, you know, that typically have no other red flags that we're going to talk about for cardiac disease, we want to send these people home, and we're going to talk about that. But really the tricky part, and the reason why I kind of moan a little bit when I see syncope on my track board, is that our job is to really decipher those life-threatening things, the cardiac arrhythmias, the structural cardiac issues, and other life-threatening hemorrhage and other diagnoses that we'll get into in a little bit.
This is actually the sensible thing, to me, the thing that makes the most sense about syncope that actually is really great, Mies, which is that all the stuff that your mom told you that could make you faint really can. And so when you're looking for vasovagal, which is usually an emotional response, usually something where, you know, you see blood for the first time, or you break up with your boyfriend. So usually there is an emotional stimulation that causes the heart rate to go down.
Oh dear, why am I smelling so?
This is a vasovagal response.
I think I should faint.
And you can identify that, and it does happen exactly the same as the orthostatic syncope, which is, you know, it's a hot day in the summer. I haven't had anything to drink all day. I'm standing up in church all day without sitting down. Those things indeed make people faint. And so when it comes to vasovagal and orthostatic, getting that history and identifying that actually does matter, because it puts those patients into a lower risk group. Doesn't mean you're off the hook for, you know, checking their heart and lungs, but it does put them into a stratified lower risk group.
So we need to be very clear here, right? The diagnosis of syncope is this broad encompassing term of lots of things that can do that. The most common causes of syncope are things like vasovagal. I don't like blood. I saw blood. That produced an emotional response. My vagus nerve fired off. I collapsed to the ground. Don't ask me why that happens, but it does. Or something like I'm a little bit dehydrated, or I've been standing up for too long, haven't been moving around, and I'm not getting that sort of pumping of blood back to my heart. Same thing again. The brain goes, we're going to have to drop you to your knees into the ground so that I can perfuse myself a little better. They are rule out diagnoses. They are benign diagnoses. So you have to decide, is this syncope, I fell over, went boom, from one of these benign causes, just an emotional reaction, or I stood up in one place for too long, versus one of the bad causes, like I'm having ventricular tachycardia.
So Stuart, tell me that there is a shift in disposition of these patients, because I think this is really the crux of the cross for most of us who are in the trenches, is what do I do with this guy who has a okay sounding history or a concerning history? Is there a good way to approach dispo?
Well, I think that what you're noticing is that probably when you try to admit these patients like you used to in the past, because this isn't your first rodeo, Mies, that you're getting a lot more resistance. Yeah. From the payers,
That's right.
From the people that are utilization review, they're saying, no, we don't authorize an admission for syncope anymore unless you've got these certain high-risk features. And so if you've noticed that, that's exactly what's happening across the country, is that there's a recognition that the vast majority of these patients that we had been admitting really can go home. And just to break that down into examples that everyone would understand, we never had a problem sending home, you know, the young woman who broke up with her boyfriend who had a syncopal episode and looks fine. No one ever disputed sending her home. We did an EKG. We sent her home. And no one disputed the fact that the guy is 85 who's had, you know, triple bypass and is having chest pain and syncope has to come in to a monitored sending. I mean, these are never in question. But all these patients that we consider to be older, and when they say older, they usually meant older than 50 or older than 55, which is not so old.
And with some comorbid diseases like diabetes or hypertension, right? Those are the patients that are sort of this indeterminate.
Exactly. And so I think most of us think to ourselves, well, all of our patients are, or most of them are over 50 and have either hypertension, diabetes, some history of MI, you know, that kind of stuff. And these are the patients that are really considered to be a little bit lower risk than they used to be, and that not all those patients have to be brought into the house. And that's really what we're going to examine.
Part two.
So as we always do, Stuart, let's just clarify one sort of confusing point up front. Clinically, I mean, you get this all the time. Someone has a syncopal event, and the first question we have to ask ourselves is, was it really syncope, or was it perhaps a new onset seizure? Sometimes it's hard clinically to distinguish. So let's talk about that, syncope versus seizure.
And let's ask an intern from Fresno, Joyce Choi, how does she differentiate seizures from syncope? I can tell you as an intern, I would have no idea.
In seizure, I would expect the patient to have either generalized shaking or a focal sign that might point to something like complex partial seizure, where they're having like eye fluttering or lip smacking, things like that. Whereas syncope, I don't expect to see any of that.
I think this is one of the cardinal things that we need to differentiate. And I've actually drawn up a little bit of a table in the notes just to draw a sharp contrast between syncope and seizure. Most of the time, these are clearly different, and you can tell the difference on history. So, for example, they're different in what happens before, during, and after the event. The usual story is that there was no warning, and the next thing they remember is that people are looking at them saying, oh my God, you fell, right? Sometimes they will tell you that they have a tunnel vision or a blackening of their vision just before they go to ground. And that's really interesting. That's basically just as the blood pressure lowers, they actually lose the blood supply to their retina. Mm. And so that's why some of them say that they did see black before they hit the ground. But other than that, you don't get much of a prodrome. With seizure, it's all about the prodrome. Patients have auras. They have odd behaviors. They might smell something unusual. They might yelp or bark like a dog.
Or have little twitches or, you know, lip smacking or something.
All kinds of weird behaviors and motor activity. All these sorts of weird things. Now, during the event with syncope, there is no during. It's a sudden event. They hit the ground and then they open their eyes and say, what happened?
Yeah.
immediately.
Yeah.
In a seizure, there's a prolonged period of convulsions, and they hurt themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They hit their head. They injure their extremities and get bruised all over the place.
They bite their tongue.
That's a critical one, is they bite their tongue. Yeah. And another critical one is incontinence. Yeah. So when their pants are wet and they've got lacerations on their tongue, that's a really big clue for seizure.
And what about after? I mean, I think that's really the key take-home point, too, that you point out, is that immediate return to baseline for syncope. But for seizure patients, they'll have that post-ictal period where they're a little bit drowsy, a little groggy. It's a little bit prolonged to get back to baseline. And
sometimes, Mies, this is something that's interesting that people should know, is that after a seizure, patients can actually have a neurodeficit that lasts for a while. There's a name for it. It's called Todd's paralysis. And so after the seizure, there might be a prolonged period where they're drowsy. And in addition, some of those patients actually mimic a stroke. And we have to think about that. But it's something I wanted people to know about because, you know, it's freaky the first time you see that. And you need to know that that isn't the differential diagnosis of a patient after a seizure. Doesn't mean you won't be, you know, calling neurology right away and getting worried if you see an arm or a leg that doesn't move. But just so people know. So the biggest differential when someone has a sudden loss of consciousness is syncope and seizure, Mies. But just to be complete, there could be other entities that are in the mix here that people might confuse us with. For example, concussion, like head injury. You know, it's happened where the patient doesn't know that they were hit in the head, right? It could be that there's occult trauma.
Yeah.
It could be that for whatever reason, you're not being told some of the history and there's a head injury going on. And that could be something that causes a transient loss of consciousness. They're not going to be totally normal after though. And they're going to have, you know, issues, whether it's repeating themselves or headache or concentration problems. There's going to be some symptomatology there. And the other thing is hypoglycemia. We never want to miss a patient who loses consciousness from low sugar. But remember, Mies, that patients with hypoglycemia are not going to immediately get better.
Right.
So they might go unconscious and they might be really sick. But unless they receive sugar,
it's not going to be fixed.
It's not going to be fixed. Yeah. And so that usually can be distinguished in that way. So that sort of rounds out our differential of, is this actually a syncopal event that we're dealing with?
So this idea of being able to work out seizure versus syncope from the history and the physical exam is really important, right? You can really go down the wrong path if you don't spend some time getting a good history working out which one it is. Very different workup. So if you go to something like the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, I found an article from July of 2002, which was a pretty big study that looked at what are the most predictive features in the history that suggest seizure rather than syncope. And the three most important ones they found were tongue biting, lateral tongue biting, head turning, and unusual posturing. Okay, so they were the three most important. Now, there are other things that they found that were pretty predictive, but not as good. Things like bedwetting, things like turning blue, things like prodromal hallucinations or deja vu, and postictal confusion, just as suggested by Mizuho and Stewart. None of these are perfect, though. None of them are perfect. And so a classic one that occurs is you've got somebody in a dental chair and they have a syncopal episode, but they're sitting up and they can't fall to ground. And then they have a hypoxic seizure that follows that. It's an absolute classic. In the dentist chair, start seizing. Everybody thinks it's a seizure, but it probably in a lot of those cases was that they fainted, but they didn't lie them down because they didn't recognize it. And then they have a hypoxic seizure, which if it's short duration, is not going to leave for them with too much damage. But again, it's the tongue biting, it's the head turning, unusual posturing, maybe prodromal symptoms, and post-ictal confusion, which suggests seizure more than syncope. But again, none of these are perfect. You have to take the entire picture into account. And if in doubt, well, you might have to work them up for seizures.
Can't miss diagnoses.
All right, Stuart, so what are the diagnoses that we cannot miss that are really important and life-threatening and concerning in relation to syncope? Let's talk about those.
Actually, we're going to ask one of our interns, Li Bao from Fresno, that question. What are the serious causes of syncope? And the point of these interjections with the interns is to get you to do the same thing, whether you're in your car, whether you're on your treadmill, whatever you're doing right now, is for you to work on developing those differentials so that if you practice it over time, and particularly if you're put on the spot, you can come up with a broad differential, a good differential, an appropriate differential very quickly. You only get good at that by practicing it. So here you go, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. What do you think the bad causes of syncope are? And we'll ask Lee at the same time.
Cardiac dysrhythmia, cardiac ischemia, hypoglycemia, toxins, bleeding.
Cool. Good.
A lot of bleeding.
All right.
So it means a lot of people, when they think about the critical do not miss diagnoses for syncope, all that comes to mind is VTAC, arrhythmia. But in fact, there's a whole host of bad medical diseases, emergencies that can present a syncope that we always have to go through.
Yeah, you like to call these the 10% diagnoses. Explain that.
Well, I mean, it's a little bit of a stretch, but a lot of these diagnoses, they say that about 10% of the time they present with syncope. Mm-hmm. So you might have heard that pulmonary embolus about 10% of the time presents a syncope. It's a rough number, but it's an important way to think about these things because I always want to go through all these 10%ers before, again, I dismiss that patient.
I like it. It's catchy.
Cardiovascular causes.
All right. So cardiovascular causes, let's talk about the big ones.
Well, for sure, an MI can present a syncope. Anyone who's having cardiac ischemia can have transiently lower perfusion, and thus they can go unconscious. So that's definite. Other ones that are huge are aortic stenosis. That's the big valvular lesion that we need to worry about. I mean, there's all, you know, structural heart disease is a big category, but the ones that we're really worried about are aortic stenosis and subaortic stenosis, which is basically another way of saying hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Those are basically two structural diseases of the heart where it can't pump blood out through the main left ventricular outflow tract. I mean, that's basically what we're talking about there. So those patients, when they need blood, you know, when they surge to do something and they need an extra bit of blood to do something, their heart can't get the blood out. And so therefore the pressure drops and they go to ground. Yeah. And so that's what those are about. Pulmonary embolus is the same thing, but instead of obstruction on the left side of the circulation, where they can't pump the blood out because of an obstruction of getting blood out the left side, they can't get blood out from the right side of the heart because the lungs are blocked, the circulation to the lungs is blocked. So they're also kind of an obstructive process where, again, they get up to do something, they need to exert themselves, for example, and there is no ability for more blood to get pumped through the lungs to the left ventricle because it's all blocked. The other things that sometimes present that way in the cardiovascular system would be a dissection, thoracic aortic dissection. A sudden tear in the aorta could give you actually a drop, could drop you to ground, as they say. And all those things need to be considered in addition to VTAC.
So let's go over those cardiovascular causes of syncope that you want to find in the emergency department and talk a little bit about what they might look like in each case. So myocardial infarction, obviously chest pain or shortness of breath. You might have some EKG changes. Aortic stenosis classically produces syncope on exertion, have a murmur in that right upper part of the chest that it radiates into the neck. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, again, classically exercise-induced syncope, bad, bad, bad. Pulmonary embolism, you know, short of breath, EKG changes. Thoracic aortic dissection, so chest pain tearing and often associated with chest pain plus neurological symptoms or chest pain plus arm pain or chest pain plus belly pain. And then lethal dysrhythmias with things like ventricular tachycardia. They're the cardiovascular causes of syncope you've got to be thinking about in the emergency department and ruling them out either through history, physical, or a few select tests. Let's now do some neurovascular causes.
Neurovascular causes.
So those are the cardiovascular causes. The neurovascular causes that you certainly would not want to miss would be a subarachnoid hemorrhage. And then always consider a stroke, of course, or TIA.
Bleeding.
And then the third category of do not miss diagnoses would be just bad bleeding, bad hemorrhage from anywhere, whether it's a ruptured ectopic pregnancy, a massive GI bleed, or a ruptured abdominal aortic aneurysm, a AAA.
Yeah, and I should say, actually, Mies, that the bleed that you mentioned, the GI bleed, it doesn't actually have to be massive. It seems that just the action of blood being ejected into the duodenum, for example, in a peptic ulcer, can be enough to stimulate that vagal response that sometimes causes syncope. So really, sudden hemorrhage, doesn't even have to be life-threatening, can cause you to drop. And so, Mies, basically, after we've gone through that fairly short list, and I think it's a fairly manageable list,
yeah,
right, of cardiovascular, neurovascular, and bleeding, once we've gone through that list, basically everything else is fairly benign. It's probably stuff that they can go home with. It's often orthostatic, it's often vasovagal, and lots of other complicated terms that people that specialize in this go into, but we don't need to get that caught up in it. We need to cover these critical diagnoses and make sure they're not present.
And so we talked about the cardiovascular causes of syncope you need to think about. Also think about the neurovascular causes, subarachnoid hemorrhage, that classic sudden onset of headache, thunderclap, often associated with syncope, TIAs and strokes, of course, and then bleeding. Bleeding you can't see, obviously. So ruptured ectopic pregnancy, GI bleeding, and of course, the old abdominal aortic aneurysm.
Part 3, initial approach.
So let's now talk about our initial clinical approach. How do you manage these guys? You get a lady that comes in with syncope. What's the first few things we always do?
Okay, First of all, IVO2 monitor is always a good place to start when we're approaching any bedside, but they don't necessarily need any of those things. I mean, again, especially this young, healthy patient who you think is likely going to be benign from the minute that they arrive in triage doesn't have to have an IV. So if they look fine and the suspicion for bad stuff is low on the onset, an IV is not mandatory. All right. Obviously, if you think that they're bleeding or they're unstable, you're going to get large bore IV access. That's a completely different story.
Agreed. And the same would go for O2 as well, right? You're not putting O2 on every patient. But yeah, if they're hypoxic or have any concerning vital signs, then you would certainly add a little supplemental O2. And then you mentioned you don't put everyone on cardiac monitoring. And I think you're talking about the young, otherwise healthy person who maybe sounds like a vasovagal or emotional event. But for everyone else, I have a pretty low threshold for putting people on a cardiac monitor. I feel like that's one of the reasons why they're there is for us to rule out a dysrhythmia. So certainly anyone with exertional syncope or any red flags for possible cardiac etiologies, those guys, I don't mind sticking on a monitor. I think that's important.
Okay, you're going to put them on a monitor, Mies. I can one-up you. If they're really high risk and there was any chest pain, or I think that this might be an acute coronary syndrome or something along those lines, I'm going to put defibrillation paddles them as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that if they do have that, I mean, why are they there? They're there because they might have a dysrhythmia.
Right.
So if they have one, you want to be prepared for it. You want to see some VTAC, you want to see some defibrillation paddles.
True.
So I think that's an important point as well. So that's basically the situation. You're tailoring it to the patient.
One of the good things, Stuart, about syncope, and I do have to give it a little bit of kudos, is that a lot of the differential diagnosis and workup can simply be done with a simple history and physical. It doesn't require a significant amount of testing, but really, if you take a good history and do a pretty decent physical, you're going to be able to narrow down your differential quite significantly.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know what? It's not just us that are saying this. It's the big organizations like the American College of Emergency Physicians has come out with guidelines that say just that. This is all about taking a good history and physical, an EKG, and then only selective testing after that. So that means you have to do a good H&P, doesn't
it?
And so you generally start with the vital signs you've already got, and they need to be normal or near normal. I mean, if you're dealing with someone who's got a resting tachycardia or they're hypotensive or, you know, something like that, you're not in the syncope algorithm we're talking about, right? We're talking about healthy looking people. In terms of the focused H&P, you can actually just think back to our list of bad things, right? And you can work your way back from that. So for example, if they have any cardiac symptoms or signs, okay, that means chest pain.
Right.
Well, that's chest pain and syncope. And that's no longer just syncope. And that worries both of us, doesn't it? If they're short of breath, well, then that's not just syncope. That's a dyspneic patient, a short of breath patient that has syncope. That's a lot worse. So palpitations as well. And we mentioned it once and we'll mention it again. Exertional syncope. If they were exerting themselves, you know, they were running for something, playing basketball, and that's when the syncope happened. Everyone agrees that that is a high risk for a cardiac dysrhythmia.
Absolutely.
Any of those things. Yeah, and any of those things will basically be putting you down the I'm concerned admit monitor pathway. On exam, the same goes for a prominent murmur or a prominent cardiac impulse, a delayed impulse, something that's abnormal on your cardiac exam that makes you think of a structural cardiac disease. That, again, all puts you into a different category. That patient needs investigations, probably an echo.
Absolutely. And maybe unilateral leg swelling if you're concerned about PE and you're going to do your PERC history there within the cardiac system as well. So certainly, like you said, take the diagnoses that you're worried about and sort of work backwards and look at those historical questions that are pertinent to those diagnoses and look for those physical exam findings. Same thing for the neurologic system. If we're concerned about a subarachnoid hemorrhage, then certainly a sudden onset, maximal onset headache is a major red flag in their history. If you're concerned about TIA or CVA or stroke, then certainly stroke-like questions and physical exam findings are critical.
I would totally agree with you. And to be honest, just the fact that a patient has a new type of headache of any sort, in addition to syncope, you really have to think about subarachnoid pretty seriously in that case.
Agreed.
In terms of the stroke stuff, it can be very difficult to distinguish a stroke that simply results in loss of consciousness from syncope, but fortunately that's rare. Most strokes are going to involve some other neurologic findings. You know, for bleeding, Mies, there's obviously historical things. Hopefully they're going to tell you if they're having rectal bleeding or if they're vomiting blood, but let's not forget, there's a critical role now for point of care ultrasound in the initial bedside assessment of these patients. You got a patient who had syncope and say, for example, they look sick or their blood pressure is low. You're going to want to really quickly with that ultrasound probe check to see that they don't have free fluid in their belly. Maybe they've got a ruptured ectopic or there's some occult trauma. You're going to want to check if they're a little bit older and they have hypertension for a ruptured AAA, an abdominal aortic aneurysm, right away. And so for some of these cardiovascular diagnoses that are really serious, including some of the things like pulmonary embolus and aortic dissection that now more and more we're able to recognize on ultrasound, ultrasound can be key.
Maybe you could find that stuff on ultrasound, Stuart, but some of us couldn't find a small Australian city on ultrasound. Look, the concept that I want to sort of bring up now, and use it if you find it useful and completely disregard it if you don't, is the idea of the syncope and syndrome. So syncope and shortness of breath, syncope and chest pain, syncope and palpitation, syncope and a murmur, syncope and leg swelling, syncope and headache, syncope and a focal neurological finding, syncope and abdominal pain, syncope and an exertional component. That's the way I think about it when I'm first talking to the patient. So you're talking to the patient and most of the time it's just plain old syncope. But if you're specifically thinking about your differential diagnosis that we talked about and then ask those specific questions or look for those specific exam findings, if as soon as you find one, you realize, this is probably not just plain syncope. Okay, I had a syncopal episode, all right? And my leg on the right is twice as big as the leg on the left. So that's the concept of the syncope and syndrome. Again, it's sort of a way of thinking about how you get your history and physical examination in a fast way. We asked the interns at Fresno about the syncope and syndrome, and to a man and a woman, they had no idea what it was. And it's because I just made it up. But if you find it useful, use it. If you don't, disregard. All right, Stuart and Mizuho are about to talk about the EKG manifestations of badness in a syncope patient. But before we get there, let's ask one of our interns again what they look for on EKG in the syncope patient. Which bad things can show up? So this is Dmitry Steblowski, I believe is his last name. And I'm pretty sure that he's going to get more than you and I are going to get. Let's go.
Okay, so you're looking for, obviously, there's typical EKG stuff, the rate and rhythm. Are they having an arrhythmia currently? You look at the intervals. The other typical things that you could look for in syncope would be Brugada syndrome, which is like typically described as RSR prime, and like a ST elevation in the anterior leads. You would be looking for arrhythmogenic right ventricular dysplasia would be a fancy one as well.
Can you please know less answers so we have something to teach?
Tests.
All right, Stuart. So in the setting of syncope or even presyncope, because EKG is so important, let's talk about the really important things to look for on that ECG. I mean, right off the bat, I think we all look for those dysrhythmias, right? Ventricular tachycardias, SVTs, so the tachycardias, and then also the severe bradycardias. I think that's pretty straightforward.
And then there's the ischemic changes. And so, you know, is there a STEMI? Is there ST segment depression? New T wave changes, new Q waves? Obviously, those patients might be taking you down an acute coronary syndrome type of algorithm.
Then there's a bunch of little things that we sometimes like to prompt our residents to really look for. So let's talk about those things, starting with, what's the deal with prolonged QT?
So it turns out, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it's really hard to describe these things. And so we made a nice little video for you. So if you follow the link on the show notes, you can see all of these bad manifestations on EKG in syncope patients. We did that for you because of the love. But in terms of a list, it goes something like this. You look for arrhythmias, you look for ischemia, you look for prolonged QT, but you also look for short QT. You look for Brugada syndrome, that RSR pattern in V1, V2, V3 with a little ST segment elevation. You look for WPW, short PR interval, slurred upstroke. You look for big voltages that suggest hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy, and you might find those needle-like Q waves, which are almost never there. You're going to look for RV strain. Maybe you're going to see some deep symmetric T wave inversion in the anterior leads, for example. And you look for something like the epsilon wave. Now that's a list. It's not necessarily complete, but that's a list. Go check out the video because a picture is worth a trillion, billion, trillion words.
Let's talk about the other tests that you may or may not get. Again, a lot of this is going to be guided by your history and your physical exam. And of course, if you see something on your ECG that's concerning, that's going to trigger you to further do more testing. But what about point of care tests? Like, how important is pregnancy test to you?
It's so important. I mean, I would never let a woman of childbearing age or even close to childbearing age home with syncope and not check a pregnancy test. I mean, it's so common and you've got to make that diagnosis. Not just for the ectopic Mies, you have to rule out ectopic in that situation, right? But just pregnancy itself,
yeah, absolutely,
can cause syncope and they need to be, you know, informed about that, and that's an issue. You know what? I try to limit this in most patients to just things I can do at the bedside. And so aside from the EKG and the pregnancy test in women, And the point of care hemoglobin, I think that's another big one.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, kind of really speaks to all those bleeding things in a large way. It doesn't eliminate the possibility that they're bleeding, but it's a big one. Between those three, I'm done in a lot of patients.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So let's go over it again. You're going to get a good history, good physical. You're going to do an EKG in pretty much everybody, almost everybody, maybe everybody. And then you're going to do some targeted testing. The targeted testing is going to be a pregnancy test in a woman of childbearing or near childbearing age, and a hemoglobin. And that is all you really need to do for most people initially. But make sure you read the EKG. Take a good look at the EKG. Look for those things that we told you about on MRAP HD.
Part 4, disposition.
All right, so now let's talk about the big one, disposition. Can they stay? Oh, do we need to bring them?
Should they stay or should they go?
Should I stay or should I go?
So, Stuart, disposition and deciding what to do with these patients is really the biggest issue. And, you know, there are different decision rules that have been created over the course of time. And I want to get your thoughts on this, such as the San Francisco syncope rule. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, there's a whole bunch of instruments or tools that have been developed to predict people's risks for bad outcomes and whether they need to be admitted after a syncopal episode. The one that I think everyone should know just because of historical significance is the San Francisco syncope rule. It's already many years old. And it has a simple mnemonic that's CHESS. And you remember what they stand for, right?
Yeah, the C stands for a history of congestive heart failure. The H stands for hematocrit less than 30%. So basically, if they're really anemic. E stands for an abnormal ECG. And we already talked about those findings. The first S is for shortness of breath. And then the last S is a systolic blood pressure of less than 90. So hypotension, whether it's due to hemorrhage or another cause.
Check.
Exactly. And so you can see right away that this is a very helpful thing for, I think, teaching purposes and for learning what some of the big risk factors are. But it's really woefully inadequate for our purposes because we just mentioned a whole bunch of really serious things, didn't we? Like exertional syncope being one of them that are not on this rule. And so it's not good enough. It's important to know that it exists and to kind of know that it really is getting at patients that have a history of either bad bleeding, blood loss, or congestive heart failure. That's what most of those things suggest, but it's not good enough, not accurate enough. Basically, Mies, syncope is a complicated complaint, and it involves a lot of processing of information on many different levels. The bottom line, Mizuho, is that syncope is complicated. Everything from was it really syncope in terms of defining it to all of these circumstances that we are describing around the syncope, it doesn't really lend itself to a simple clinical decision rule. And so they're all fallible. They're a great springboard to kind of remind us of, you know, definitely don't send them home if they've got, you know, hypotension. Definitely don't send them home if they're syncopized and they're very anemic. Right? It tells us those things, but we have to have a more comprehensive list that we're going to present to people. And fortunately, as time has gone on since the development of the San Francisco syncope rule, we're getting more precise in defining what is really high risk and what is not. So the rules probably oversimplify things and they put them into too much of a binary thing, you know, blood pressure greater than 90, lower than 90, you know. And so I think in 2016, what we're moving towards is a more clinician-oriented, judgment-based triage of these patients from the emergency department. And that seems to be panning out, actually, Mies, with some recent literature that shows that we can define very nicely, actually, low, intermediate, and high-risk groups using our overall gestalt, just with a few specific things added in there. So I'll share that approach with you.
The Squadron Gestalt, high and low risk.
Patients that are low risk go home, and they don't necessarily need much in the way of follow-up. So that's all your younger folks that have fairly straightforward histories of a vasovagal or orthostatic event and an EKG that looks benign.
And they don't have exertional syncope, because in young people with HOCM, even with a normal-looking EKG, if they have a history of exertional syncope, they might still be able to go home, but they need an echo and strict exercise restriction until they've been sort of cleared of HOCM, right? An EKG alone is not sufficient to exclude HOCM. So I agree with you. The young, healthy person whose history sounds like vasovagal can likely go home with a normal EKG.
As long as it's not exertional.
As long as it's not exertional.
And in fact, Mies, if you look in the high-risk categories that I've defined, exertional is right there.
Yeah.
And it's a high-risk thing. The chance of an adverse event to one of these truly low-risk people that we've talked about is very, very small. On the other hand, Mies, we now are getting a clearer idea of a high, high-risk group. I say that because the incidence of a serious life-threatening cause of syncope in this group might be around 30%. That group includes patients with exertional syncope, patients in whom there's some suggestion on the history and physical of an acute coronary syndrome, valve disease, if they actually have arrhythmia on their EKG, there is VTAC on the EKG that you take in the ER, if they've got an implantable AICD, if they're known patients with CHF and that's actually going on, all those things, Mies, are high risk. They need to be admitted and monitored.
The Squadron Gestalt, intermediate risk.
All right, Stuart, but then let's talk about that big group in the middle, the intermediate risk patients, and what the heck do we do with them?
So that's what's really exciting about this topic, if I can find something exciting about syncope, which is that that group that doesn't have those clear high-risk features that we've mentioned and that doesn't have obvious low-risk features, we know that that patient population is a lot safer than we used to. We know that if we handle those patients properly, we can send them home and not miss a lot of bad things. So let's say, for example, that patient that's 61 years old, he's diabetic, you know, he's not a spring chicken, but he doesn't have exertional syncope. There's nothing, you know, the exam is normal, the EKG looks okay. That's who we're talking about here. In days past, we all would have admitted that guy. Oh, he's over 55 or he has comorbid disease. Nowadays, when we do our HMP and we don't find any of the real high-risk things that we've mentioned, we know that those patients are great candidates for outpatient management because the adverse incident rate in that population is real low, probably in the less than 2% range that is acceptable to most of us.
So I have a question. So are you sending these patients home with like a Holter or a Zio patch or anything? Or are you just saying that they don't need any cardiac monitoring at all?
So for the intermediate risk group patients, Mies, there's a variety of options. Often we can discharge them home after a conversation with cardiology and some shared decision making, saying, you know, Dr. Cardiologist is going to see you in the office in a couple of days. If you have any new symptoms, come back. There is some risk, you know, and you can give them some idea of the risk. You know, you need to be comfortable with that, similar to the risk that I send people home with chest pain and shortness of breath for ruling out PE and MI. I mean, it's a very similar situation in terms of stratifying them down to something like about less than 2%. And those are probably pretty reasonable numbers for this intermediate risk group. Other options include sending them home on a cardiac monitor. And many systems now have a system in place where these patients can actually be fitted with a home cardiac monitor before they go. And the whole pathway for their CARDS follow-up is all in place. Another option in patients who perhaps you have maybe just a bad feeling about, although they're strictly speaking in the intermediate risk group, is observation in the hospital on a monitor in some sort of ED observation unit. That gives you that extra few hours of monitoring and reassurance that there have been no life-threatening arrhythmias. Because you know, Mies, for each hour that you monitor these people and you don't see a lethal arrhythmia and they're doing okay, you kind of buy yourself that much more reassurance that they're going to be okay.
It's a very simple but straightforward approach, low risk, intermediate, and high risk breakdowns. Thanks, Stuart.
You're more than welcome. The pleasure was all yours. It wasn't that bad, was it, Mies?
No, it was good. That is much more helpful, much more practical, and I think will make the pain of seeing syncope show up on my track board a little bit less next shift.
I hope so.
Summary.
And I'm supposed to summarize all that, am I? It's going to be difficult. Look, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, when somebody comes in with syncope, your initial approach has got to be, this is something bad, all right? So you don't necessarily have to do IVO2 monitor on everybody, depending on the circumstances, but you certainly should be thinking about it because what you're doing here is trying to pass out the many people who just have a vasovagal benign form of syncope from the few people who have something very bad. And so when you first see that patient, if they're stable, you've got time to do the most important thing, which is take a very thorough history. If they're unstable, then you have to get busy, IVO2 monitor, and start resuscitating them. And when it comes to syncope, there are two broad groups. There's the cardiovascular causes of syncope, which have a poor prognosis, and then there's all the other causes, which tend to have a good prognosis. So on your history, you're going to ask for things like, do you have chest pain? Do you have shortness of breath? Do you have palpitations? Do you have exertional syncope? Now that's really important. Exertional syncope is basically bad, 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 bad. It's aortic stenosis, it's hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy, it's something like that. It's bad. Then you ask for neurological symptoms. Do they have new onset headache? Did they have a thunderclap headache, for example? Did they not able to move their arm or leg before they syncopized, for example? You start thinking about they've had a neurovascular event. And then bleeding. You're obviously going to ask about bleeding. And in terms of the physical exam, you're going to go look for bleeding. And in terms of quick tests you could do at the bedside, you can do an ultrasound. You can slap it on their belly. You can see if there's free blood. You can see if there's an abdominal aortic aneurysm. And you could do things, if you're sophisticated enough, like look for aortic stenosis, look for hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy, look for right ventricular strain of pulmonary embolism, for example. And in terms of tests as a routine, what do you have to do as a routine? Well, I think EKG is a reasonable thing to do in all of these patients, looking for things like dysrhythmias, looking for ischemic changes, looking for prolonged QT, looking for a delta wave, looking for a Brugada pattern, looking for an epsilon wave, looking for signs of right heart failure, looking for signs of left ventricular hypertrophy. And again, we suggest that you go watch our EKG in syncope video. Further tests past that, and maybe a hemoglobin, really are very, very selective and really depend on what you got out of your history. And so some people, as a routine, as a bare minimum, get an EKG, get a hemoglobin, and get a pregnancy test in somebody of childbearing age as the baseline, and then go off and do tests after that. Now, your management is directed by the results of that history, physical, and initial examination. For some patients, it's, I don't know, for some patients, it's, oh, I really think they've got a PE and I'm going to have to start working them up down that algorithm, or I think they're having an MI and I work them up down that algorithm. So it really comes down to disposition. Sick people obviously stay. Low-risk patients can go home. So what's a low-risk patient? That's somebody who's young, healthy, EKG normal, looks like on the physical exam, on the history, that it's just a vasovagal cause, there was no exertional component. That group of people can go home. The high-risk patients, they have to stay. Who's high-risk? People with exertional syncope, people with known or a real concern for acute coronary syndrome, people with valvular disease, as evidenced by their EKG, or you can hear it on their exam, or you pick it up on ultrasound. People who have a history of ventricular arrhythmias, people who have an implantable cardiac device that didn't work and they syncopized, people with known CHF, or people with any of those concerning EKG findings. So high-risk is usually pretty easy. That intermediate risk, they're not really the young person with nothing wrong with them. They're not really the older person or the person who clearly has something bad going on. But that group in the middle, well, there you might want to keep them for a while. You might want to watch them. You might do a couple of EKGs. You might want to put them into an intermediate observation area. And remember that chest mnemonic. The chest mnemonic, or the San Francisco syncope rule, says, is there evidence of cardiac failure? Is there evidence of a hemoglobin less than 30? Is there an abnormal EKG? Do they have shortness of breath? Do they have a systolic blood pressure less than 90? If they say yes to any of those things, then they're a fairly high-risk group. But remember, that is a blunt instrument. There's a lot of high-risk patients that say no to all those things. And the classic one is the kid with exertional syncope. They don't have congestive heart failure. They have a normal hematocrit. They may even have a normal EKG. No evidence of shortness of breath and a systolic blood pressure, which is completely fine for their age. But every time they run, they collapse because, you know, they've got hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy or they've got aortic stenosis. And you do not want to miss that. The chest mnemonic is good as an overview, and it's good to sort of write on the chart in yellow risk patients, but it is not the only thing to use. It is a blunt instrument which misses specific subgroups. And the reason it misses specific subgroups is because these syncope studies were done in thousands of patients. But the diseases we're talking about here, which, for example, again, the exertional syncope, might occur in one in 10,000 patients, one in 100,000 patients. So unless you do a truly enormous study, you're not going to pick up that select group of patients. We know it through more empiric evidence, but we know it very well. So don't forget it. So ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, let's call it done. That was a pretty thorough review of syncope. Go watch that video. And here's an outtake because it was a very hot day when they laid this down.
I literally have drips of sweat going down my back.
I know, me too. Me too.
All right.
So some final things. First of all, to our patient that we interviewed at the beginning that Jess spoke with, well, he had a cardiac workup and ruled out. He didn't get a stress test. He didn't want that. He was found to be a little subtherapeutic on his seizure meds. So currently, we still are not exactly sure whether he was a seizure or a syncope patient, but he's a great example of a real life situation where it's really not clear. He's got some features that suggest syncope, and he's obviously got some history that suggests that it could have been a seizure. So thanks to Jess. Thanks also to the interns that she interviewed from Fresno. I thought they did a fantastic job. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, my name is Mel Herbert. That was Mizuho, and that was Squadron, and they did syncope. This is the C3 Project, and we're out!